Chapter 7. On a singularly beautiful morning, well south of those vile calms and enervating breathless heat, the Surprise hauled to the wind well off the looming American coast, and Jack, walking up and down with a piece of toast in his hand, said, "Stephen, do you choose to go into the top?" With this gentle, steady roll, the masts scarcely move at all. "Is it the sugar loaf you wish to see?" "I should be happy to see the loaf. Indeed, I can already make him out on the rise. But for this occasion, I could wish him away, since what really concerns me at present is the activity in the port. The coming and going, the yards. And the sugar loaf hides almost everything. But I shall have to send Ringle in any case to arrange for victuals, water and wood. Perhaps you'd rather go in her?" "Not at all. I'm perfectly willing to climb to whatever pinnacle you choose." "Mr. Hanson," called Jack. "Mr. Wells, the doctor's going aloft. You will act as hand and foot fast, as and when required." "Aye, aye, sir. Aye, aye," they replied. And he swung himself into the absurdly familiar ladderway, mounting with the smooth ease of a powerful, very well-trained body to the main top, where he greeted the lookout and drew breath for a while to ease his friend's somewhat more laborious progress. Stephen arrived, pale and, if not anxious, then truly worn, followed by his attendants. And they all sat for a while, gazing at the mainland and the schooner with the captain's glass. It was quite true. The masts were in no considerable state of motion. Yet, even so, at the next stage, the not very awful crosstrees, Jack said that that would answer very well. He gazed for a while, pointing out various remote inland heights, and then, reaching out for a backstay, his own expeditious form of descent, he desired the young men to see the doctor safely bestowed when he wished to return to the deck, and so vanished. Arriving with little more than a muffled thump, he caused Ringle's signal to be thrown out, requiring her to come within hail, and then, spurred by the scent of breakfast, he hurried into the cabin. Presently Stephen joined him, paler still, but with the assurance of one who now walked upon comparatively firm ground. Killick plied him with coffee, bacon, sausage, toast, and quite soon his equanimity and even cheerfulness resumed their usual placid height. "I do hope," said Jack, "that Dr. Jacob would be so good as to accompany William into Rio, and, speaking Portuguese, find out all he discreetly can about the asp. William will know all the questions to ask, but it would come much better through someone not obviously English. Someone, say, who was acquainted with her in Valletta before she left the service, and who naturally takes an interest in her. Am I right in supposing that ideally William should be a passing figure, preoccupied with other maritime affairs, and that Jacob should be an idle passenger walking about the docks to see something of Brazil, largely ignorant of the sea but interested in his earthbound fashion?" "You're wholly in the right of it, brother. That's exactly what I should have asked. A trifle of coffee?" At this point, Killick announced Mr. Woodbine's desire to see the captain directly, or almost so, the near approach of Ringle, and the news that those African cats had got at the mangoes. "And what they ain't et, they've spoilt," he added with an obscure, surly triumph. Mr. Woodbine's mission was concerned solely with a certain deviation from truth on the part of the Pintles, observed and exactly measured in this pellucid calm, a deviation forecast by Mr. Seppings when he installed the new stern post, the correction being provided by three simple operations clearly figured by young Mr. Seppings in a drawing to be found in the case holding the necessary implements. The next interview was nothing like so satisfactory. William Reed didn't feel that his explanations of a series of basic questions about the revived asp had penetrated the layers of Dr. Jacob's ignorance of both English and Portuguese nautical language. He knew very well what Captain Aubrey wanted to learn, but he felt that apart from making the usual arrangements for water and stores, he was going on a fool's errand. You might as well try to shave with a butter knife, he muttered, taking his seat next to a sombre Jacob in Ringle's gig. On the other hand, Jacob, though indeed as impenetrably stupid in some respects as the most prejudiced seaman could wish, was also a remarkable draughtsman. This was, of course, most apparent in his beautifully exact and explicit anatomical drawings, but he was perfectly capable of changing scale, attitude and nature of description, and his drawings, produced in the cabin from rough sketches and combined with Reed's vivid technical description, gave Jack Aubrey a very clear impression of the renewed, the almost entirely rebuilt Asp. I doubt I should have recognised her, sir, with this fine long line running aft. He traced in on Jacob's profile. And I must do the doctor the justice of saying that he couldn't have struck it off better had he been bred to the trade. My only question is whether, with these extra feet, she'll be as windwardly as she was. Her one good point. Faster, for sure, but as windwardly? I wonder. I dare say you're right. Jack didn't choose to be more specific, but he spoke gravely. And as William Reed carried on with his description of the Asp's improved armament, including a most elegant pair of long brass chasers right forward, his face, ordinarily so cheerful, grew graver still. My dear, wrote Stephen, many a year have I spent sailing the sea in ships, but rarely have I felt such a corporate sense of concern. It's certainly not a defined uneasiness, for the surprise is sound, as all hands know. She's well supplied, and she carries an ample crew of seamen perfectly well used to working together. Yet there's a want of cheer, of those conventional jokes, semi-insults, and jocular repartees that make up so much of the very small change in shipboard life. And what puzzles me extremely is that it is quasi-universal. It may spare the midshipman's berth and the little small gathering of ship's boys, but it's fairly general elsewhere. I noticed it first when we were lying in the wholly sunless estuary of the River Plate, having sent the tender over that vast and, as far as I could see, birdless waste to Buenos Aires, carrying, among other burdens, a message to you, in which I pointed out the extraordinary contrast between your African water, teeming with both familiar and wildly exotic duck, geese, anhingers, waders from the most minute of stints to Arde a Goliath, and this prodigious desert, inhabited perhaps to the extreme limit of my glass by one molting black-crested grebe. How ardently I hope that my note may reach you in Dorsetshire, bearing as it does more affection than is ordinarily enclosed in a common sailcloth cover. It is true that I date this gloom, untoward atmosphere from our dreary sojourn on the River Plate, and for a while I foolishly tried to account for its mood by the absence of creatures, but of course that was sad nonsense. As soon as the schooner rejoins, and as soon as we resume our course, we shall necessarily begin to see the southern birds. Already, before we dropped anchor here, a few skuas from the Falklands had been observed, and in a very short time the various penguins will be commonplace. No, I must find a more rational basis for this prevalent mood. Part of it may arise from the odd in-between nature of the season, neither one thing nor another. Much more from the general knowledge that we are to sail into the Pacific by way of the Horn rather than attempt Magellan Strait, which Jack Aubrey dislikes extremely, taken from east to west. The farther reach is calling for some manoeuvres that are exceptionally perilous in a strong westerly blow. I think it may fairly be said that no one man in a ship has as much influence as her captain. And I believe that the strength of that influence is very, very much increased when the captain has commanded the ship her officers and her company for many years, which is, of course, the case with Captain Aubrey. His expression, his daily mood, his tone of voice are naturally, automatically and universally observed, not out of curiosity or intense personal interest, but as any man, sailor, farmer, fisherman, subject to the weather, frequently looks at the sky. Now, except as a friend, I'm not particularly subject to the great man's state of mind, his état d'âme. Yet I find myself curiously affected. Here the letter came to a halt, starting again many days later with a different pen dipped into a different ink and written on a somewhat discoloured sheet of paper. My dear, it is not without a real regret that I see the absolute loss of so many pages, swept off by an intemperate gust, pummeled and pounded by intrusive sea water intimately mixed with ice, swilling with the utmost violence about the sodden cabin, while poor Surprise lay on her beam ends on one of the innumerable uncharted reefs in this forbidding part of the world, and while I and the blessed Pulse keeping bandaged, splinted and dosed the hands, injured by a gun forced from its emplacement by the furious thrust of ice. At present, we are on an even keel once more, gliding under courses and close-reefed topsails along the inward, the leeward side of one of the countless islands that fringe this desolate end of the world. These pages, now reduced to pulp, were little more than a kind of diary, a daily musing that I like to share with you, reports of the increasing number of penguins, even some emperors, albatrosses, petrels great and small, seals, of course, and sea lions, and that beautiful, sinister creature, the killer whale, sometimes in numerous bands. But they did contain an apology for addressing you in this familiar style, which I justified by the fact that as I was not an absolutely and formally rejected suitor, such a degree of ease could be considered permissible, though perhaps blameworthy, even indelicate. And they contained a passage that described our coming to the Cape of the 11,000 Virgins, beyond which lay the broad and tranquil mouth of Magellan's Strait, perhaps a dozen miles across. The wind was fair on our larboard quarter, yet there was no call to change sail or course. The seamen lined the landward side and they watched the strait go by. Most with a face as grave as their captain's. No remarks of any kind. The silence broken only by the regular stroke of the bell. Since then, and since our passage of the Strait de Mer, which leads only from one part of the main ocean to a worse part a little south, we have had foul weather, far, far more ice than is usual at this time of the year, and a very strong wind has a far greater southerly component than most ships encounter. And, of course, this makes the ice much more dangerous, much more plentiful. It's mostly floe ice, great flat sheets of no great depth, rarely more than our skilled whalers, and we have several aboard, and the bow grace with which we are adorned can deal with, but occasionally great ice mountains are to be seen, sometimes, when the sky is clear, of an extraordinary green, blue or turquoise beauty. Our whalers say that as the season advances, above all with so much south in the wind, we shall see many more. From a purely aesthetic point of view, they are a most noble spectacle, for these great and continuous winds with so very long a fetch build up monstrous waves, perhaps 100 feet tall, and when they break against an even taller mass of ice with enormous deliberate force, it is a very magnificent spectacle. Yet their presence, and the presence of the vast waves, the largely adverse winds, oblige us to make what westward advance we can achieve under the lee, the sometimes astonishingly complete lee of the many, many islands. Sometimes, after days of perpetual and wearing fight against the weather, we will put into a sheltered bay, rest, fish, mostly for a kind of succulent cod, and dredge up enormous mussels from no great depth. We're lying in just such a bay at present, and Jack Aubrey and I have supped on these same delights. As I think you know, when he was a boy, he was acquainted with the Byron family. There may have been some family connection, I'm not sure, but in any case he knew the Admiral, nicknamed Foul Weather Jack in the service, admired him greatly, and often repeated his anecdotes. You may recall that when he was a midshipman, the Admiral sailed in the Unfortunate Wager, one of the squadron with which Anson made his famous circumnavigation. The Wager was wrecked in the Chonos Archipelago, and Byron and some of his shipmates lived among the Indians of those parts, lived very, very hard indeed. And he would tell how the women, some of whom were quite kind to him, would do practically all the work. It was they who handled the canoes, for example, fragile craft perpetually oversetting, and few of the men could swim, whereas the women were taught from childhood. And they did the fishing, laying out nets and then setting their dogs to drive the fish into them, little intelligent, smooth dogs, sometimes painted, that could dive and swim underwater. They cooked, too, and made what few clothes any of them ever had. But most went bare or with just a piece of sealskin slung about them and kept to windward. The men walked about the strand gathering fuel, sometimes hunting, but not with much success. They did make fires, however, even when everything was sopping wet, as it usually was, and they signalled with the smoke, passing messages to a considerable distance. But, my dear, I wander, and it's time for my rounds. Hands have been piped to weigh the anchor. The deck echoes with the steady tramp of feet, the click, click, click of the pawls as the cable comes home. And I remember now that we were to profit by the making tide to move to a headland from which we could see the main ocean, the open sea. Eight bells. The usual morning rituals, one of which was Stephen's rounds. The sick berth was sparsely inhabited at present, but one cot, containing a Swedish whaler called Bjorn, who had broken three ribs in a recent blow, already had a visitor. Hansen, to whose division the seaman belonged. "You are doing very well," said Stephen, in that rather loud, distinct voice that even quite intelligent medical men use to their foreign patients. "And if Mr. Hansen will call a shipmate to make sure you do not fall, you may go up on deck for a while now that the ship is so still." The morning ceremonies also included breakfast, and while they were eating it, Stephen said, "It's very pleasant to see how the young men take care of the hands who belong to their division. Ever since the boisterous weather that filled the sick berth, there's not been a day when two or three of them haven't come to ask how their shipmates do." "It would be a damned odd, unhappy ship where they didn't," said Jack. "There's no right feeling where the officers don't feel a real concern for their men. If you were to serve in other ships, I think you'd find it much the same throughout the service." Stephen didn't wholly agree, but he said nothing. And before he'd poured his next cup of coffee, Hewell, the officer of the watch, came in and said, "I beg pardon for interrupting you, sir, but we've just opened the strait and I'm afraid it's blowing very hard outside and the making tide is coming through like a millstream, carrying awkward great lumps of ice." "I'm sorry to hear about it, Mr. Hewell," said Jack, "but unless our reckoning is very far out, it'll be slack water before long. Pray drop a kedge, but keep the breeze right aft so that we can look through the strait when we choose. I shall be on deck directly." "My dear," wrote Stephen, "I followed them on deck. We were still in the lee of the tall black cliff to larboard, with just steerage way on us. But overhead the wind raced across the gap with a deep and steady roar, while through the passage to the open sea the awkward great lumps of ice to which Mr. Hewell referred were irregular masses the size of a moderate haystack, presumably the fragments of some huge ice mountain that had driven with full shattering forces on the outer cliff. We, though not Ringle, might have survived a glancing blow from one of them, but there seemed no hope whatsoever for the canoe that was trying to cross the tide at its farther extremities, I mean on our right-hand or starboard side, where the current ran violently up the shore. For some moments I didn't understand what was happening, but then Hansen and his seamen quickly explained and passed me a telescope. In the canoe was a young woman with a piece of seal skin over one shoulder and a paddle in both hands. In the floor of the canoe, covered with nets, half a dozen small crouching dogs. Right aft, an older woman, completely naked, holding a basket of fish and an equally naked baby. They all glistened with the rain and flying spray. It was just not freezing. The girl, with an extraordinary mastery of her craft, tried again and again to slip between the great blocks of ice, often touching but never being upset. We watched with the most extreme attention and anxiety. At last, the blocks coming in an almost uninterrupted train, she spun the craft round, and now, running with the current as it curved across the channel to our side, she ran within hail. Captain Aubrey called out, offering a rope. She dared not take it. I think the check would have destroyed the frail canoe. Bjorn shouted and she replied. Someone threw a blanket clear into the older woman's grasp. She was seen to smile, and they were swept on along the shore, checking their way on a small shingly strand with something of a hovel behind it, smoke from a fire, and some naked men who sauntered down for the fish, the dogs and the blanket. Very soon after this, with one of those dream-like changes, the tide fell still. Jack hailed Ringle, lying there under our lee, and desired her to look out through the pass, the channel, and report on the state of the sea and the ice. Then, calling Hansen and Bjorn, he told them to join us in the cabin. There, he gave them some coffee, and speaking mainly through Hansen, who was not only Bjorn's immediate officer, but who was thoroughly used to his way of speaking, he asked for a general account of the situation. For example, did Bjorn understand the language of these parts? Yes, sir, he did, more or less. Had been wrecked in the Ingeborg out of Malmö, some way to the west in Wigwam Reach and beyond, ship burnt to the waterline, and only 5 men reached the shore. The people were quite kind, took most of their belongings, but gave them food. They were mad for knives. Had no knives, no metal. They gave him a girl for his second best knife. So after a year or two, he lost count of time, he came to understand them quite well. They were fairly decent people, but they didn't know cleanliness. Their language was called Tlaxcala. No, it wasn't spoken right along the reach, far from it. Another nation lived, say, 50 miles westward, and they couldn't understand it at all. When the two nations met, they usually fought, and the stronger side took everything they could carry. And beyond that nation, the Woner, there was yet another, and so all along Wigwam Reach. Some of them ate men's flesh, some did not. But they all signalled to their friends with smoke. A pause, and Bjorn murmured to Hansen, would the captain know about Wigwam Reach? Hansen blushed, overcame his confusion and said, sir, Bjorn wonders whether you know about Wigwam Reach. Please ask him to tell me all he can. Well, sir, said Bjorn, I don't want to shove my oar in, but Malmö and Gothenburg whalers, homeward bound and in no hurry from the far south fisheries, quite often use it, above all when there is so much south in the winds off the Horn like it is now. The Wigwam Reach is a sheltered passage, not this one just west of us at present, but the next after it. A continual lee and slow, of course, but it goes on and on 150 miles or more past Cabo Pilar into the Pacific. It's the far end of the Magellan Strait. To be sure, the Indians are mostly wicked, which worries the whaling ship, but a man of war has nothing to fear. Well, thank you, Mr. Hansen, said Jack, standing up. Thank you, Bjorn, and I hope your poor ribs will be better very soon. My dear, wrote Stephen again in a jagged, uneven hand, although he and his stool and his desk were so clamped together that nothing but his wrist had independent freedom. The ship and the sea upon which she was, at least for the moment, suspended, knew no such limit. We are in the boundless ocean once again, and blessed by what they very oddly call a favourable wind, we are sent in our tumultuous headlong way something north of west. We have, of course, as I probably told you in one of these countless rambling, disconnected and profoundly ignorant pages, long since rounded the dreaded Cape Horn, and now Captain Aubrey has decided that duty requires him to waste not a minute in the placid navigation of slow, sheltered waters, but to press on, come tempest, come dreadful ice, come wounded spars and threadbare wounded ropes, and now come the approach of famine. Our supplies of everything but water are running very, very low. The shortage is already perceptible in the sick bay, where old wounds open for a nothing, where there is evident debility and perhaps the first signs of scurvy. Three men and a boy have died of plain, uncomplicated pneumonia, and poor old Mr. Woodbine is sinking fast under a complication of inveterate, self-treated maladies. But what can medicine do in such cases other than ease the end without deliberately provoking it? Himself, and by that I mean Jack Aubrey, for he does indeed personify the ship, has become grave, stern, unapproachable. He asks no man's opinion, and I have the impression that he knows exactly what he's doing, that he sails with the same determination and clarity of mind as the great albatrosses that sometimes accompany us, black-browed, wandering and royal. Although I am by now quite an ancient mariner, long accustomed to the ways of the ways of the ways of the service and the sea, it does surprise me to observe the steady force of usage, custom, necessity and discipline. The people, weakened by loss and now by short rations, are worked very hard indeed. Putting a ship about in such seas and with such winds in very, very cold weather is extremely wearing, and they've been kept to it for what seems an unaccountably long time. Yet I have heard no complaints, no short answers, no cursing of an awkward shipmate. The gaiety is gone, of course, but an astonishing fortitude remains, even among the ship's remaining boys and the midshipmen. Once or twice I've heard the captain check an officer, but it's very rare. He and I eat together, as we've always done. Yet this clearly is not a time for intimacy. And it's a great while since we candidly exchanged our minds. I only remember him nodding his head over the last of the coffee and telling me that towards the end of the graveyard watch he had suddenly remembered the Delaware's present of a cask of Jamaica rum, as yet unbroached in his private storeroom. The men will go through hell and high water to save the barkie, he observed, but if you touch their grog, I shouldn't like to answer for even the best of them. So the grog is safe, for a while at least. And unless I quite misunderstood the conversation in the gunroom, the extreme anxiety of our dwindling stores, our very few casks of barely edible horny beef, is likely to be relieved since we are steering, or attempting to steer, towards a small group of islands laid down on three separate charts, reasonably near what passes for the coast in these latitudes. For this, though you may find it as hard as I do to believe, is the beginning of the Antarctic spring. The whole cycle of life begins again, and we hope thereby to preserve our own. What light there was is fading, but not this evening, under the usual cloud of small-flaked snow, but of a sombre driving rain. And so, my dear, I bid you good night. God bless. Some days later, on Thursday, a very weary Dr. Maturin eased himself into the same writing place, looked automatically at his close-scrubbed hands again, and dipped his pen. "My dear," he wrote, "it is perhaps no more than a piece of hedge law, but I've heard men say that butchers cannot be allowed on a jury, they being so daily accustomed to blood that all tenderness is washed out of them. And for my own part, during my medical studies, I was intimately familiar with the dissection of the dead. It's true that at first I had to overcome a certain reluctance, indeed an extreme reluctance, but I thought I had conquered it entirely. Not at all. The carnage of yesterday and the day before distressed and sickened me beyond what I had thought possible. The weather was exceptionally kind, and we, Surprise and Ringle, headed into a sheltered bay, there dropping anchor in perhaps 20 fathom of water, pulling into the shore over a moderate swell through ice that presented no great difficulty. Yet already there was death at hand. Just by the blue cutter in which I sat, a leopard seal made a lunge at one of the smaller penguins, which shot into the air like a little rocket or a cork from a bottle, landing on a small ice floe. The shore itself was a most striking spectacle, divided into rookeries, as they say, for the various kinds of penguin, various levels for the different species, and then strands, rocky or smooth, appropriated to the seals according to their kind, and one particular cove to the vast sea elephants, whose enormous males, as I'm sure you know, were a fleshy great proboscis and rearing up, utter a hellish roar. Above them all, on the sparse herbage of the upper island, wheeled terns, three or perhaps four kinds of albatross, petrels and skuas. And with a glass one could make out sitting birds by the hundred. As I think I've said before, several of our hands have sailed in whalers or sealers, and they were perfectly accustomed to the slaughter. The others, after the initial bawling and excitement, settled down deliberately to knocking the medium-sized seals on the head, while those with some knowledge of butchering cut them into reasonable joints for salting. What merriment or wanton brutality there was soon died away, and I was able to prevent some unnecessary suffering with a scalpel. It was an extraordinarily bloody, extraordinarily unpleasant exercise, carried out for the most part in a phlegmatic, workaday fashion. It distressed most of the boys extremely, excited a few others. By good fortune, or perhaps I should say good management, we had salt in plenty. So there is our hold and Ringle's hold, filled with barrels of seal and sea lion flesh, as rich and nourishing a meat as you could wish. I did, however, notice that although the very real fear of running out of provisions in the far South Sea had certainly vanished, yet a certain cloud hung over the ship. It disappeared after grog and an enormous supper of fresh seal steaks, and stupidly I didn't attend to the proportion of those who were affected, than those, mostly countrymen and accustomed to killing as a matter of course from childhood, who were not. Yet I did notice, since we were in the same boat, that Hansen and his particular friend Daniel did what little they could to hide their distress in our many bloody voyages to and fro, with the skuas screaming just over our heads.